Welcome back to Everybody Money, the podcast where we dive into the world of money without the jargon, the condescension, or the old guys yelling at you about your coffee habits. I'm your host, Kyle, the least qualified person on the planet to host this show, but I'm here because I believe learning about money doesn't have to be so difficult. In today's episode, we're diving into a topic that's increasingly important for many people, navigating taxes as a gig worker or someone with a side hustle. This could sound like kind of a random and niche topic to cover for what is just our second episode, but it's a topic that is increasingly relevant to a growing number of people. Fiverr, the freelancing website, did a survey showing that nearly 75% of Americans are thinking about adding some sort of freelancing to their careers. So whether it's driving for a rideshare service or freelancing online, selling crafts, side hustles can be a really powerful way to boost income, but they also bring their own set of tax implications that can be less than straightforward. So all that to say, I wanted to get this episode out before tax day, or as much before tax day as I could. I know we're close, but just in case it might be helpful to someone at the 11th hour. So let's start by talking about the tax obligations and implications for someone who is a freelancer or a gig worker, whether part-time, as a side hustle, or full-time. Money you earn from your gig or side hustle is taxable, and that's true whether it's your main job or a side job. And it's true whether you received a tax form in the mail or not. So if you're the sort of person who fills out all the tax forms yourself when you do your taxes, first, why? But two, you might have seen the Schedule C form. That is the catch-all form for all sorts of self-employment income. If you're an independent contractor working for a company like Uber, or if you have your own one-person business, this would be different if you have a larger business with employees, but if you're a single business, like a single proprietorship or an LLC, you would typically fill out a Schedule C when you're doing your taxes. Of course, if you're like the rest of us and you use a software like TurboTax, they will fill out the Schedule C for you. So you just fill out this kind of usually called a self-employment section and usually have to pay extra to have access to that. But you fill that out in the software and then they do the rest. All that to say that gig work, freelance work, self-employed, one-person run business, all of that is kind of falling into this broad catch-all category of self-employment income. For some gig work, you might receive a 1099 form in the mail. This is the tax form used by someone or a company when they hire an independent contractor. So just like a W-2 is a form that a company uses when they report income for their employees. There's a few, or really a lot of circumstances where you may not receive a 1099. One is if you didn't make $600 from a particular entity, they aren't required to fill a 1099. And that's the case even if you did other jobs through another platform or another company in the same business. If you did some deliveries for DoorDash, for example, and you got a couple thousand dollars for the year, you'll probably get a 1099 from them. But if you also did some other deliveries for another platform, just a couple, maybe you made 30, 40 bucks on Uber Eats or Shipt or Instacart, you're probably not going to get a 1099 from them because they didn't pay you $600. Self-employment income in all of these categories is subject to income tax on the one hand, just like any other income. The difference is that unlike income you might earn from a full-time employer when they're issuing a W-2, is that there's likely not any withholding during the year. So at a kind of traditional job where you get a W-2, your employer typically sets aside some of your income across all your paychecks, and they send it right to the IRS for you. That's your withholding. And when you get to tax time, you get all the paperwork, you plug in all your numbers, and you see if you withheld too much or too little, and then you settle up with the IRS. With gig work, probably nothing was set aside. In some cases, it might be, but often not. So you're going to owe all the income tax on your gig work because you haven't paid anything yet. At least in theory. We'll get to deductions in a minute. Plus, on top of that, you're going to owe an additional amount of self-employment tax. This is to cover Medicare and Social Security taxes that, again, would normally also be taken out of your paycheck at a W-2 traditional job. Currently, the self-employment tax is a little over 15%. An important thing to know about, though it's too late for 2023 taxes, is quarterly estimated tax payments. Since taxes aren't automatically withheld from your gig income, you may need to make estimated tax payments throughout the year to avoid a penalty when you file your tax return. It's basically DIY withholding. You can check on the IRS website to see what the rules are, and they're changing from time to time, so I'm not going to put them here because they may be out of date by the time someone sees this, but you can check the IRS website to see what the rules are for when you're supposed to submit quarterly payments and how much you need to have made in order to do that and all that. As a gig worker, you're eligible to deduct business expenses that are both quote-unquote ordinary and necessary for your work. And this can significantly lower your taxable income. Examples include your mileage and vehicle expenses. This is, of course, a huge one if you do any sort of rideshare or delivery. You deduct the mileage, or you can add up all the actual expenses you had, oil changes, gas, et cetera, et cetera. The mileage is typically easier. You just put in how many miles you've driven, and then there's sort of a standard average rate that's supposed to try to capture all the things that you may have to pay for with your car. Another deduction is a home office. If you use part of your home exclusively for your business, you might be able to deduct that. Supplies and equipment, like a computer, software, other tools can be deductible. And then fees. Fees are a big one, and something that people don't always talk enough about, or it's something that can easily slip by if you're not paying attention. So if you contracted through a company like Uber, you can deduct the fees you paid to them. This gets a little tricky, though, because you may not even be fully aware of all what those fees are. And I'll keep using Uber as an example because, for one, I can speak from experience from here. I have been an Uber driver off and on in the Boston area for about 8 years. So when you give a ride as an Uber driver, the passenger pays their fare. And technically, this whole amount is your income, at least as far as the IRS is concerned. You are an independent contractor, and they, the passenger, is your client. However, Uber charges you a fee to use their service, specifically the app, which pairs you with customers and helps you manage all the transactions and stuff like that. And that fee is taken out automatically before you even get paid. So it's just like if you are a freelance video producer and you pay a subscription for the editing software you use, or you pay a transaction fee to Stripe or some other payment platform in order to get paid by your customers. With Uber and similar services, Instacart, all of this is processed automatically before you even see the money. And there are important and good reasons for why that's the case. It's a lot more convenient. You don't have to get all this cash and then later have to pay all these fees that you forgot about. So it helps make that process a lot simpler. But what this means is that when you receive your 1099 from Uber, your 1099 is going to have the total amount of fares that were paid to you before the fees were taken out. Because again, as far as the IRS is concerned, that is your income. That's your money because you're an independent contractor. So I've heard rumors. I don't know anyone's personally necessarily, but I've heard a lot of rumors, and it makes sense because it would be easy to do, that people who pay up more taxes than they're supposed to because they put in that 1099 amount, not realizing that that number doesn't account for the fees. So Uber, again, as an example, provides an annual summary document that will show you how much you paid in fees. Plus, it has some other things like how many miles you drove. And so you'll deduct those numbers that are on that document. All that to say, if you are an independent contractor through a third-party platform like Uber or Etsy or Fiverr, be sure to look carefully to make sure you understand the numbers on all your documents and make sure you're not missing out on some important and sometimes really huge deductions. One of the keys to managing your taxes as a gig worker is keeping meticulous records. This is another place where people sometimes can shortchange themselves. For example, again, Uber, and you know, we could say the same with Instacart, only tracks the miles when you have a passenger, or in Instacart's case, when you have a delivery item, the bags, the groceries, whatever you've picked up to deliver, when it's in the car. But the IRS allows you to also deduct the miles when you're on the way to pick someone or something up. So you receive a ping on Uber and you go to pick someone up, or you check an order on Instacart, you grab it, and then you go to the store to shop for it. That driving also is deductible. So the miles you drove there would count as part of your mileage deduction. There are lots of apps these days that can help you do your own mile tracking. You can't really count your time from your starting location, like your house, to your first pickup. But everything after that, you just turn on the app, press a button, and it just starts clocking your miles. And for other types of gig work, you want to keep track of inventory costs or how much you pay in different websites you may work through, which can get complicated if you're working through multiple different ones. You know, I've just started with this podcasting thing, and I'm, you know, trying to make sure I come up with a system for keeping track of the different things I'm having to pay for or have paid for as part of this process. I'm paying subscriptions for a platform for audio editing. I pay a subscription to ChatGPT because I use it to help me with research and with editing my scripts. All of those things are potential tax deductions that you want to keep track of. And a lot of things can help you with this. Of course, a simple spreadsheet is good enough for a lot of people, or even the budgeting apps or platforms that a lot of people use for their personal budgeting can be helpful for this. Mint used to be the big name in this game of different budgeting platforms, kind of easy to use, integrated budgeting platforms that integrate with all your bank accounts and pull in your information automatically. Mint is done, it's gone out of business, but there's been a lot of other apps that have emerged kind of in its place. A lot of these make it very easy to tag certain expenses as business expenses, and then you can easily just see the list at the end of the year and tally it up for your taxes. A couple other tips for success. One is to stay informed. Tax laws change, so it's important to stay updated or consult with a tax professional if you're unsure about something. And speaking of which, this is probably a good time to say that I am not a tax professional. Let me say it again. I am not a tax professional. As the podcast intro said, I am the least qualified person on the planet to be hosting this show. So please don't take my word for anything. This is just for educational purposes, sharing knowledge to the best of my ability. But you should do your own research, your own double checking, and speak to a tax professional if you think you need one. Okay, and then another tip is separate your finances. Something you can consider is keeping a separate bank account for your gig work to simplify tracking your income and expenses. But like I said, a budgeting app can also help with this too, or you could do both. Depends on what makes the most sense for you and helps make sure that you don't miss anything. And then the last tip is to plan for taxes. Again, this is not relevant for 2023 tax year at the moment because we're past that. It's about to be due. But going forward for this current and coming years, you can set aside a portion of your gig income for taxes if you haven't done that before, so you're not caught off guard when tax time rolls around or when it's time to make an estimated payment. And you can keep track and see if you're doing enough record keeping to get all your deductions. Another thing is reevaluate regularly to make sure you're keeping careful track of everything you'd want to deduct. When I was an Uber driver, I heard lots of different people give rules of thumb of how much to set aside regularly for taxes. And it's tricky because in the United States, we are on a marginal tax rate, right? So the rate that you're taxed depends on how much income you make. And the different parts of your income are taxed at different rates. So it gets kind of complicated to keep track. So it's a little bit hard to predict, like in the middle of the year, what tax rate am I going to be in for my income tax? The self-employment tax is pretty easy. It's 15%. But of course, then that's going to be reduced because of all the deductions that you're going to add later. It can be really hard to predict what is good to save. I tended to be fairly conservative. I think I have tended to do like 25%. So 25% of everything I earn, I set aside into a savings account. And I try to pick something that's earning interest, so it's just, you know, it's doing something while it's there. But that way, I make sure I'm not surprised or caught off guard at the end of the year. Best case scenario, I give myself a refund and I can use that for something else after I've paid taxes if I don't need it all. So to wrap up this conversation about gig worker taxes, tackling taxes as a gig worker or side hustler can be daunting, but there are some tools you can use to help make it a little more manageable and help feel a little more organized and hopefully make sure you get what you're owed and you don't pay more than you should for taxes.
It's time for our segment, In the News with Spencer, the part of the show where we flip typical business news on its head. Instead of a human reading words that might as well be from an alien, we have an artificial intelligence reading actual human words that anyone can understand. Recent developments are changing the traditional real estate market, particularly concerning the commission rates charged by real estate agents. Often when people buy or sell a house, they use a real estate agent. Buying a home does not normally require paying a fee to your agent. It's described as a free service. They take you around to different homes and help you prepare the paperwork to make an offer and help guide you through the rest of the purchasing process. In this situation, you typically don't pay the agent anything. Selling a home, on the other hand, involves paying a commission that averages around 5 to 6% of the home's sale price. So, how does the buyer's agent make money? There are two ways. First, the buyer agent uses this as a way to get new clients. They help you buy your house, then they hope you will call them back when you are ready to sell. But second, the buyer agent often also requires that the seller's agent split the fee charged to the seller. This is basically what the buyer's agent wants as a payment for bringing a good potential buyer to the seller and helping make the deal happen. The change comes amid growing concerns and legal challenges over the transparency and competitiveness of real estate agent commissions. Most agents work through the National Association of Realtors, which carefully protects the current system. Although the 5 or 6% fee is not required by anyone, there are a lot of barriers that prevent buyers and sellers from negotiating or trying to avoid these fees. And the National Association of Realtors has sued and tried to undercut any new companies that try to offer different ways to engage in this process, like apps that try to make home buying mostly digital and charge less fees. Some people see this as something like a monopoly, where there is not enough competition or options for customers. The National Association of Realtors, known as the NAR, has recently faced legal challenges coming from sellers who claim they were misled or misinformed about how these fees work and the options they had for negotiating the fees. The NAR recently settled in court, with the consequence being that they will have to change the fee process. Basically, sellers' agents cannot decide ahead of time or advertise a particular plan for how or if their fee will be split with the buyer's agent. The seller will have an individual agreement with their agent about what fee they will owe the agent for making the sale. Similarly, the buyer will have their own individual agreement with their agent about what fee they will pay the agent for helping them find and buy the house. The decision about who pays these fees will be negotiated as part of the offer and sale process. This change will likely have lots of consequences. Some see the changes as positive, others see these changes as negative, and lots of people see both potential positives and negatives. It depends on who you ask. For example, on the one hand, these changes will theoretically end the incentive for agents to only show their clients homes where they know ahead of time they will get a certain commission. In the current system, buyer's agents might not show their clients' homes where the seller's agent is charging less than 6% or is not planning to split the commission. In the new system, this goes away. The buyer's agent knows they will get a certain commission decided between them and the buyer when they first start working together. But they don't know if they will get any of the seller's commission as well. This will be determined as part of the negotiation of the sale. On the other hand, this means that buyers are ultimately going to be responsible for their agent's fees. When a buyer and an agent start working together, the agent will let the buyer know what their commission is. The buyer will then have the option to shop around for realtors with lower fees, or they might decide to not use an agent at all. If they do go with an agent, this doesn't mean that the buyers necessarily pay the fee, however. The buyer still might strike a deal where the seller pays all the fees to both agents. But the problem that some people see is that this makes the whole process more complicated for buyers and puts buyers who can't afford their agent's fees at a disadvantage. A buyer might have trouble finding an agent whose fees they can afford. Or if they plan to ask the seller to pay the fees for them, they may not be as competitive compared to other potential buyers. However, this is not exactly a new problem. In the current system, buyers might ask the seller to pay some of their closing costs. This is less common in a competitive housing market where the seller has all the advantage, but in other circumstances, this is not unusual. Even in today's competitive market, a buyer might ask the seller to pay some of the fees and closing costs, but they will offer a higher down payment or a higher price in exchange. In some cases, this might be successful. In other cases, it might not be, but it's not a new idea. The point is that it is hard to predict exactly how all these dynamics will play out. One thing is almost certain, however. This change is probably going to transform the home buying and selling process a lot. And that's what's in the news.
Thanks again for joining me today. Remember, the goal of Everybody Money is to demystify the world of personal finance one episode at a time. If you have topics you'd want to talk about that you'd love to hear covered in future episodes, don't hesitate to reach out. Our website, our email are all in the show notes and the podcast description. We'd love to hear from you.